The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Confide something in you. This probably isn't wise, but I'll give a confidence here. I haven't taught this course before. That's probably been evident enough, but I'll tell you the truth. I first designed the course to be the material that I gave you today, to go through the content, you see. And then I realized, well, you need some introductory material to that. So then I figured I'd tack on that old and new business. So I tacked that on. Then I figured, well, you're going to need some more guidance on how topology hangs together. So you ought to have just the rudiments of that. So I tacked that on. And so here's the course, and it's almost over. And we just began this morning what I had intended to be the course. Now that, however, I take some consolation that maybe what we did will prove more helpful than what we might have done. because in going through the content and seeing Christ as he's revealed in the Gospels, then as we look back at each step and see what the Old Testament background is for that step, we're dealing with material that you are familiar with and that you are studying all the time, the doctrines of Christ and the Gospels. So maybe it is really more important to get the perspective on it, to get the approach, the Old Testament background that I've been trying to give to you. But now, seeing how rapidly our time is evaporating, I don't want to leave you short in some further discussion on how to do it, how to build these sermons with this kind of insight in them. So my purpose just now is to leave you with these outlines as suggestive material to reflect on, to say a few words more about Christ, the wisdom of God, which I had already introduced, but then to arrest it at that point and go on to consider the structuring of sermons that will utilize this kind of material. And I'll put up a couple of sermon outlines on the overhead, and we'll talk a little bit about the way of doing it, and then if you want to ask questions about particular texts, we can look at them and discuss them. So let me try to bring this rapidly to a conclusion on dealing with Christ, the wisdom of God. I've been talking about the incarnate word in terms of the miracle of the incarnation, who he is, and the fact that he came into the world. Now you know in the Gospel of John, he plunges immediately into the outcome of the incarnation, the paradox of the rejection of Jesus Christ. As the darkness refuses the light and the creation rejects the Creator, and even his own receive him not. And of course, here is a very important point to notice all through the Gospels. You see it when Jesus summarizes his ministry, when he says, teaching the disciples from Moses and the prophets, in Luke 24, that the Son of Man must suffer these things and enter into his glory. There's always that tension of presentation in the Gospels. The glory of Jesus Christ, the wonder of who he is, but then his rejection, his suffering, his death, and the contrast between the suffering and the glory. And you have that right at the outset of the Gospel of John. The contrast between those who reject him and those who receive him. And those who receive him, they behold his glory, and they receive his life, and they enjoy his fullness. We beheld his glory. Glory is of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. And that connects, you see, with the next section here in this outline, seeing Christ as the revealer of the Father. And there, you see, I would jump to the end of the Gospel, or the discourses at the end of the Gospel, and refer you to the word of Jesus to Philip, when Philip says, "Lord, show us the Father, and it sufficeth us." And I reminded you earlier that there's a beautiful parallel between what Philip says and what Moses says. You know, in Exodus chapter 33, you have Moses saying to God, "Show me your glory. Lord, if I could just see you, if I could just see your glory, then the problems would be over." And Philip says the same thing. And it's very, very fascinating. But Jesus talks about the way. He says, the way you know. And, you know, the disciples, "How can we know the way? We don't know where you're going. How do we know the way?" Now, when Jesus talks about the way, don't forget that that, too, has the Old Testament background. The whole conception of the way is an Old Testament conception. In the book of Deuteronomy, God is leading his people along the way. Deuteronomy 1, 29 to 33. Take a minute and look at that. Deuteronomy 1, 29 to 33. Moses summarizing way in which Israel had not had the faith to enter into the land. "Then I said unto you, dread not, neither be afraid of them, the giants in the land. The Lord your God, who goeth before you, he will fight for you according to all that he did for you in Egypt before your eyes, and in the wilderness, where thou hast seen how that the Lord thy God bare thee, as a man doth bear his son, in all the way that you went until you came into this place. Yet in this thing you did not believe the Lord your God, who went before you in the way to seek you out a place to pitch your tents in, pitch your tents in fire by night, to show you by what way you should go, and in the cloud by day." Now notice the close analogy of the wording there. God went before them in the way to seek out a place for them where they could dwell. And God bears them in the way and carries them in the way. And you see, Jesus is the personal way. He says, "I am the way, the truth, and the life." And Jesus calls for faith in contrast to Israel's unbelief. You believe in God, believe also in me. Jesus calls for faith. And then Jesus charges them not to be afraid. And you see, Israel was afraid. They were afraid to enter into the land. And Jesus says to them, "Don't be afraid. I am going before you in the way, and I'm going to prepare a place for you." And Jesus, as the Son, is himself led of the Father, and he leads the disciples. And here in Deuteronomy, you have the cloud of glory represented. And John saying, "We beheld his glory, glory is of the only begotten of the Father." He goes before in the way, indeed he is the way. And Jesus overcomes the enemy, John's told us that in the 12th chapter of John. And Jesus goes before to prepare a place. And the way is the way of life. "I am the way, the truth, and the life. Because I live, you shall live also. I am the resurrection and the life." The risen Christ breathes the spirit of life into his disciples. And he is the truth, because he is the fulfillment, the reality. Grace and truth came by Jesus Christ. So we are to understand that Jesus Christ, when he says he is the way, we're to understand that there's a rich Old Testament background to all of that, the well-known way in the wilderness by which God led his people. And that's the same picture when Jesus says to Satan, "Thou shalt not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceedeth out of the mouth of God." Again, a quote from Deuteronomy. You see, it isn't as though this is highly speculative that Jesus should think about Deuteronomy. Jesus knows all of Deuteronomy by heart, obviously. And when he's in the wilderness, he quotes out of the book of the wilderness to Satan. As Israel was tested, now he's tested, the true Son of God. But Jesus presents himself as the way. Now, it's against all that background, I am the way, the truth, and the life, that you have the question of Philip, show us the Father, and it suffices us. And then Jesus says, Philip, have I been with you so long, and you ask a question like that? What have I been doing? All of my ministry, what has it been but to show you the Father? He that hath seen me hath seen the Father. And the revelation of Jesus Christ is a revelation of the Father. And that little outline there, Christ is one with the Father, and he is one with us. He is one with the Father in his coming. He is one with the Father in his going. He is one with the Father in his coming because he is the Son of the Father as the Son of the Father. But he is also one with us in his coming. You see, Moses' prayer was, show us your glory. Well, Moses didn't see the face of God. He did see the back of God. He was a recipient of a revelation of the glory of God. But you see, what Moses saw, only in a symbol, only in a cloud, and a cloud of glory, and even the theophanic appearance of the back of God, was not yet the fullness of the revelation of God's glory. So that glory now is revealed in Jesus Christ. Now the reality has come. And therefore, Philip shouldn't be asking, show us the Father. Because now we beheld his glory. Glory is of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. The glory of the Son is the glory of the Father. I and the Father are one, Jesus Christ says. And therefore, in seeing him, he sees the one who is one with us in his coming. One with the Father, but one with us. You know, it's a wonderful thing to reflect on, because Jesus says, blessed are you who haven't seen and yet believed. And we haven't seen. And the disciples saw. And we haven't seen. But we can believe. And, in a sense, the faith is the same, isn't it? I don't buy the position of Soren Kierkegaard, but he's written some very insightful things. And one of the things he brings out very powerfully is, you think it would be so much greater if you had lived then and had seen Jesus, you know, seen him really in the flesh. But are you so sure? A man that you can eat fish with or go out in a boat with, that he is the living God? Would that be so easy? Apart from the opening of your eyes to believe. It wouldn't be easy at all, would it? Apart from faith, your reaction would be the same as the scribes and the Pharisees. Who do you think you are? You say that if any man hears your words, he'll never die. What kind of a claim is that? See. But Thomas's eyes are open. My Lord and my God. Well, it's a wonderful thing that he's one with us. He's the God-man. And that's in his coming, but also in his going. He's one with the Father in his going. He goes to the Father. And he is the way to the Father. He's going to be at home with the Father. He's going to rejoin, as it were, the glory of the Father. And he goes to the Father by the way. He says, I am the way. And what is the way to the Father? Through the cross. He has to drink of the cup that the Father has given him. And he is one with the Father in that. And there's John 3:16. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. You see, it is the Father who gives the Son. And Jesus is one with the Father in going to the cross. He does the will of the Father as he goes to the cross. The whole atonement is the plan of the Father, and it is the expression of the love of the Father, and he is one with the Father in the redeeming love that makes the cross a necessity and a reality. And then he's one with us in the presence of the Spirit. He gives the Spirit to the disciples. So in his going, he continues to be one with us. When he goes, it doesn't mean he's not with us anymore, because he says, it's better for you that I go, because I come. And there the coming is in the Spirit, so his going is also a coming. His going to be with the Father, since he is one with the Father, is the source of the coming of the Holy Spirit to us. And we are better off to have the Holy Spirit than to have the physical presence of Jesus Christ. It's better for you that I go, Jesus says. And then it's... He's one with us, of course, as the truth and as the life. And he is one with us because he gives us the very life of God by the power of the Spirit. And he gives us the very truth of God, the reality, the fullness, the actualization. Yes?
How do you relate to Jesus being the way to the central portion of Luke 9:51 through 19, where Luke concentrates on that short journey from Galilee to Jerusalem? Jesus sets his face to go to the cross. That whole middle section of Luke deals with it that way. How would you relate that to Jesus being the way to that journey?
Sure. You're already doing it, aren't you?
Well, I'm wondering if in a more general way, would there be parallels with Israel's journey?
Yes, you see, he is walking the way in obedience to the Father, that is the way to the cross, the way of self-sacrifice. And at one level, that is the obedience of faith. You see, Jesus walks to meet the enemy, Satan himself. He walks to put himself in the power of the enemy. And that journey, when he sets his face as a flint to go to Jerusalem, that you're right, from Luke 9 on, that whole section, that he's going to his death, and he knows that he's going to his death. And that is, in a sense, the supreme testing of the Son of God. You see, the wilderness testing was sort of that in review in advance. You understand. It was not the whole reality. Okay. But I think your point is well taken, that here is another evidence of the prevalence of the theme of the way, the journey going to the cross. And so I'm just calling your attention to a little bit about that. Now, one more thing before we leave the wisdom material. If you just turn to Matthew 11, verses 29 to 30, look at that for just a minute. You see, it's not just in John where you have Christ as the Logos, as the revealer of the Father, as the one who is the truth, as the one, therefore, who is the source of all wisdom. It's not only in John you have that. You have it also in the Gospel of Matthew, and notably in the 11th chapter of the Gospel of Matthew. And we all know that verse 28, "Come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest." And then there's verse 29 that doesn't get as much play often. "Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, for I am meek and lowly in heart, and you shall find rest unto your souls." Now there Jesus reveals himself as the Lord of the yoke, as the one who summons us, as the Lord of wisdom to come. And the call of Jesus is the call of wisdom. Let me read to you Ecclesiasticus chapter 51, verse 23 and following. Ecclesiasticus 51, 23. Now, Ecclesiasticus, may I remind you, is not Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiasticus is the wisdom of the son of Sirach, a book written that is not in the Old Testament canon, but a book that is written in the tradition of the wisdom literature. And in this book of Ecclesiasticus, we have these words: "Draw near to me, you who are untaught, and lodge in my school. Why do you say you are lacking in these things, and why are your souls very thirsty? I opened my mouth and said, get these things for yourself without money. Put your neck under the yoke, and let your soul receive instruction. It is to be found close by. See with your eyes that I have labored little and found for myself much rest." Now, you can't help but be struck with the similarity of vocabulary and of theme in these two passages. Jesus is certainly alluding to this theme from the wisdom literature. But what does Jesus do? He doesn't here speak of wisdom as a woman, as he does in Matthew 11, 19, and wisdom is justified by her works. Nor does Jesus paraphrase the book of Ecclesiasticus by saying, I am a teacher, and I can teach you about the yoke of wisdom, and I myself have found much rest as I followed the precepts of wisdom. See, that's what the son of Sirach is saying. Son of Sirach is saying, I'm a teacher of wisdom, and with little labor I've found much rest, and I recommend to you the yoke of wisdom. Put it on. But what does Jesus say? Take my yoke upon you, and learn of me, for I am meek and lowly in heart, and you shall find rest unto your souls. But when he says, take my yoke, not wisdom's yoke, but my yoke, that is a marvelous transformation. It may seem only a little shift of words, but it's an amazing shift of meaning, because Jesus presents himself as the Lord of wisdom. And you say, how can he make a claim like that? How can he summon us to come to him as one who has the wisdom of God, as one who is greater than Solomon, as one in whom Job's search is forever ended? Remember in the book of Job, he's looking for wisdom in chapter 28, and he says, where can wisdom be found? And if you could dig a deep mine and get down and dig it out of the earth like rubies, wouldn't that be great? But you can mine out all the earth and you'll never come up with gems of wisdom down there. Where is wisdom to be found? And the end of Job 28, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Only in God is wisdom to be found. Wisdom is God's attribute. That's the doctrine of the Old Testament. Jesus says, come to me, take my yoke upon you. My yoke is the yoke of wisdom. Of me you can learn how to have much rest with little labor, and to be delivered from the oppressive bondage that makes you so weary. Come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. But then notice, how can Jesus make a claim like that? How can he call men to him and claim to have the very wisdom of God? Preceding verses give the answer. Jesus says in verse 27, all things have been delivered unto me of my Father, and no one knoweth the Son save the Father, neither doth any know the Father save the Son, and he to whomsoever the Son willeth to reveal him. There's your answer. How can Jesus call men to him as the one who gives them the very wisdom of God, indeed as the one who is the very wisdom of God? How can he do that? Because he is the only Son of the Father. And therefore, only he knows the Father. What a claim. See, only he knows the Father. Yes?
Remarkable prophetic passage connected with that is, for what it's worth, is Isaiah 50 in verse 4, where it says, "The sovereign Lord has given me an instructed tongue to know the word that sustains the weary. He wakens me morning by morning, wakens my ear to listen like one being taught. The sovereign Lord has opened my ears, and I have not been rebellious. I have not drawn back." And it is that concept that he has a unique relationship with the Father, and therefore he has unique wisdom.
Yes, and of course what you have there is the servant as the one who is instructed and given wisdom. And that's here too. But see, this goes even beyond that, because he's the Son. He's not only the servant who's instructed of the Father, and Jesus uses that, you know, he says he gives you the words that the Father's given him. But you see, his knowledge is the knowledge of sonship. So only he knows the Father. Again, there's an analogy here. You see, a lot of people knew, a lot of people know your father, or if your father has passed away, a lot of, maybe many of his friends are still living. People knew your father, right? And, I knew Jonathan Mayo's father, and I could say I had some knowledge of him. But I didn't have Jonathan's knowledge of him, did I? You see, he had a son's knowledge of the father. So his knowledge of the father, of his father, was unique, and is unique. Now, that's an illustration. That's a parallel, in a sense, right? And we all know what that means. But see what Jesus says here. Nobody knows the Father. See, my knowledge is not only so qualitatively different because I am the eternal Son of God. You know, quite apart from sin, he's the uncreated Logos, and therefore his knowledge of God is the comprehensive divine knowledge. Only the Son knows the Father, and therefore only the Son can reveal the Father. And here we are creatures, and not only creatures, but fallen creatures, and sinners, and blinded by our sin. So how are we going to know the Father? Only if the Son reveals him to us. And of course, if anything could be even greater, it's the statement that only the Father knows the Son. See? Jesus is making a divine claim there. He himself is such that only God can know him. Only the Father can know him. And you have then that beautiful picture. No one knoweth the Son save the Father, neither doth any know the Father save the Son, and he to whomsoever the Son willeth to reveal him. So that's why Jesus says, "Come to me, and I will reveal the Father. Come to me, take my yoke upon you, learn of me." And then you learn that amazing thing that the yoke of Jesus is easy and the burden is light. And of course, that's a masterpiece of understatement, isn't it? The yoke is more than easy. It's a yoke of salvation. It's a yoke of grace. It's a yoke that grants to us eternal life. Well, it means, of course, keeping Christ's word as Lord. It shows that the tradition that he has is the tradition he's received of the Father. And yet, amazingly, Jesus Christ is not only the master of wisdom, but Jesus Christ is in submission himself as the servant under the yoke. "I am meek and lowly in heart." And his meekness is a meekness under the yoke of the Father. And therefore he shows us the compassion of the meek King, the meekness and gentleness of Christ. And not only his compassion that he is meek and lowly in heart, but ultimately his passion. Because the yoke that Jesus takes is at last the yoke of the cross. At the cross, the wisdom of the world is made foolish, and Jesus Christ is made unto us wisdom and righteousness and sanctification and redemption. Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example that you should follow in his steps. Well, we'll arrest this at this point. I've just given you a very cursory look at this business of Christ as the wisdom of God, and we just won't have time to begin to go through the material that's outlined in those other sheets. I do hope that you'll continue to reflect on some of these things as you continue your study and preaching and teaching in the New Testament. But now what I would like to do is to review with you just some of the aspects of preaching from these passages with a view to the use of the kind of material that we've been discussing. Now, let's see, we have about 2 minutes, so we'll get started on this at this point. First of all, let me say a general word about structuring these sermons, and I want to say a word, too, about interpreting the parables of Jesus Christ. Suppose I do that first. Just say a word about the parables as a special case of presenting Christ from the gospel material. In the early exegesis of the parables, there was a distinct influence of the allegorizing approach that you found in the Hellenistic world. Now remember, I mentioned to you how much allegorizing went into Hellenistic speculation. And if you want a little quick survey of that, look under allegoreo in the Kittle Theological Dictionary, and there's a little summary of the allegorizing that went on in the world of the Hellenistic age. And there you see a direct historical connection between Greek allegorizing and Philo's allegorizing and the allegorizing of the Alexandrian school of early Christianity, the kind of allegorizing that appears in Origen. Now, the parables were all interpreted in a highly allegorical way originally. After the Enlightenment in Germany, you had a man named Ulliker who wrote about the interpretation of parables, coming at it from a literary point of view and saying that a parable is an extended simile. And the point of the simile is the point of comparison. That if you say a man is like a lion, you don't mean that he's particularly hirsute, or you're not describing his hairdo, or you're not suggesting that he has a tail. When you say a man is like a lion, you presumably have in view some particular leonine quality, like the alleged bravery of lions, something like that. If you're going to interpret my statement, this man is like a lion, you wouldn't be fair to me if you began to say Ed Clowney says that man has a tail. You're misrepresenting my meaning. So Ulliker argues that in the parables, what you are doing is finding the point of comparison, the so-called tertium comparationis, the third in which the comparison is being made and in which the comparison exists. So with that in view, students and preachers began to ask, what is the point of the parable? In what way is the comparison of the parable being made? And find that central point of comparison, and then working out from that point of comparison, understand what the parable is teaching you. Where you have the importunate widow coming to the unjust judge, The point of comparison is the importunity which Jesus is advocating. And therefore, you can't argue from the parable that God is an unjust judge. In fact, you see, once you get the right point of comparison, the point of importunity, then the fact that in the story Jesus makes the judge to be an unjust judge gives the parable greater force, obviously. Because if an unjust judge who has no better motivation than to be free of the bother of having the woman always knocking at his door, if he will give her justice just to get rid of the nuisance so he won't be hassled anymore, then you see, how much more will your Heavenly Father, who is a just judge and not an unjust judge, how much more will he hear you as you come with importunity with your requests and prayer to him? You see how important it is to start with the point of comparison in understanding the force of the parable. And Ulliker made that point. Now, in more recent studies of parables, however, that has been modified somewhat. So if you read C.H. Dodd on the parables, or if you read Joachim Jeremias on the parables, you will see that, or Black on the parables, you will see that they qualify Ulliker a bit. Because you look at Jesus' interpretation of the parable of the sower, and you realize that Jesus does begin to explain this parable point by point, doesn't he? He says what the ground by the wayside, what that represents. He says what the rocky ground represents, where it's only thin soil and rock underneath. And he says what the thorny ground represents, the ground where the seed falls among thorns and grows up. So you see, point by point, he finds significance in the elements of the parable. All right, you say, then how do we interpret parables? Which way do we go? Is it an allegorical interpretation that is biblical because it's like Jesus's? Or is it a tertium comparationis interpretation, as Ulliker would recommend? Well, I think when you study C.H. Dodd and Jeremias and some of these other interpreters, you see that you really do both. That is to say, the parable does have a point of comparison, and you have to find out what that point of comparison is. But the parable, with its point of comparison, is often enriched by the use of symbols that have an established scriptural antecedent. So that in interpreting parables, you may rightly ask, are we dealing here with elements that have a familiar Old Testament background to them? Are there elements in this parable that suggest Old Testament antecedents that are illumined by scriptural use? Now, obviously, you have to be cautious as you do that, because, for example, when Jesus uses the parable of the leaven and likens the kingdom to the working of leaven, he's using a figure that's familiar from the Old Testament. But in the Old Testament use of leaven in relation to the ceremonial law, you know that it's perfectly true that the leaven was a symbol of uncleanness, of that which it was polluting. Therefore, in the Feast of the Unleavened Bread, you have to search the whole house to make sure there's no leaven anywhere and get rid of all of it. And Jesus, surprisingly, takes an image that's used of leaven in the bad sense and applies it to a good sense, to the sense of the gradual influence and spread of the gospel through the world. But nevertheless, you still must be alert to these things, to the biblical backgrounds in the language of the parables, because often there is a suggestion in the parables that goes beyond the immediate a point of comparison, a kind of enrichment thing as other symbolical elements are drawn into it.